91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour, we visit with preeminent constitutional lawyer, Professor Erwin Chemerinsky. He's the founding dean of the University of California, Irvine School of Law. Hello, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. The U.S. Supreme Court session is 1 month old. It will likely give decisions on abortion rights, affirmative action, the Affordable Care Act, and marital equality. Professor Chemerinsky has written a non-legalese book entitled The Case Against the Supreme Court. The book examines Supreme Court actions over the past two centuries. And of course, we'll be taking your calls. That's Topical Currents after an update of NPR and regional news.
And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. Well, this hour we visit with renowned constitutional lawyer and author, Professor Erwin Chemerinsky. There we go. I'm sure he's had that before. He'll discuss U.S. Supreme Court issues and decisions over the past 200 years. He's the founding dean of the University of California, Irvine's School of Law.
Professor Chemerinsky's latest book is The Case Against the Supreme Court. He says the court has largely failed at important tasks throughout American history. And he joins us from station KCUI in Irvine, California. Welcome to you, Professor.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, it's great to have you. Any thoughts on yesterday's elections and how that might impact the Supreme Court or any forthcoming decisions?
It could certainly have an enormous effect on the Supreme Court if a vacancy occurs in the next 2 years. Imagine that Ruth Bader Ginsburg or one of the other justices retires or illness happens. President Obama's ability to pick a successor is going to be very limited with a Republican Senate. When there was a Democratic Senate this past summer, President Obama could have pretty much anybody he wants. Now President Obama can only pick someone for the Supreme Court who can appeal to the Republicans.
I listened to an interview in which you were saying that Justice Ginsburg should step down at the end of the last session. Was that why?
Well, it's exactly what I was saying. I wrote this in the LA Times last March. I said that Justice Ginsburg should step down this past June or early July at the end of the last term of the court. I said if the Republicans took the Senate in November, then President Obama's ability to pick her successor would be limited. If a Republican wins the White House in 2016, then the odds are her seat would be filled by somebody with a very different perspective. I said if she wanted someone with her values and her views to take her place, it would require that she step down this past summer. She obviously didn't take that advice.
Yeah.
Your book is called The Case Against the Supreme Court. But you say you've long revered the Supreme Court. So when did the change occur?
I still revere the Supreme Court. As recently as an hour ago, I was teaching constitutional law to first-year law students. But I also realize, if I look critically at the Supreme Court, that it's so often failed, often at the most important times in American history. And it was over the last few years in teaching constitutional law that I came to realize that so often I've been making excuses for the Supreme Court and that we need to look at it much more critically and much more openly.
Well, let's go back a little. Why was the Supreme Court created, and has their role ever clearly been defined?
The Supreme Court was created to interpret and enforce federal law, including the Constitution. It's interesting that the Constitution nowhere explicitly says that the Supreme Court has the power to declare unconstitutional a federal law or state law or an executive action. It was in 1803, in a case called Marbury versus Madison, that the Supreme Court said that it's the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. I think Marbury was right. The limits of the Constitution only have meaning if they're enforced, and we need the court to enforce them.
And whose court was that, the Marbury versus Madison?
It was a court that a justice appointed by Presidents George Washington and John Adams. It was a court that was headed by one of the most famous justices in all of American history, Chief Justice John Marshall.
What are the most historical egregious court decisions in your opinion? I guess maybe Dred Scott would fit in there.
Dred Scott certainly is high on the list of infamy. In Dred Scott versus Sanford in 1857, the Supreme Court ruled that slaves are not citizens, even if they're born in the United States. They're just property owners. The court declared unconstitutional the Missouri Compromise and helped precipitate the Civil War. We could point to Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, where the court said that separate but equal is constitutional, and the court ushered in the Jim Crow laws that segregated every aspect of Southern life. We could talk about Korematsu versus the United States in 1944, where the court upheld the evacuation of 110,000 Japanese Americans, aliens and citizens, and 70,000 were United States citizens, and placed them in what President Franklin Roosevelt called concentration camps. But I can pick less famous examples. The book begins with the story of a case from 1927, Buck versus Bell, where the Supreme Court held that a state could impose involuntary sterilization on those that they deemed to be intellectually disabled. 60,000 United States citizens were subjected to involuntary surgical sterilization because of the Supreme Court decision in these laws.
Professor Chemerinsky, if you would tell that story of Carrie Buck. It's an awful story. Tell us what happened and how that court, how that became a Supreme Court case, and then the aftermath.
Of course. Carrie Buck was born in Charlottesville, Virginia in 1906. She went through the local public schools. By all accounts, she was a normal child. Her father left her mother. Her mother was then destitute. Her mother had no choice but to put Carrie and Carrie's sister Doris in foster homes. When Carrie was 17, she was raped by her foster father's nephew. Carrie became pregnant as a result of the rape. Her foster parents were humiliated by Carrie's pregnancy, and they had Carrie institutionalized in what was called a home for the feeble-minded. Carrie gave birth to a daughter there. After that, the state of Virginia began proceedings to have a tubal ligation performed on Carrie Buck. This was using a new Virginia law, a eugenics law. Many states had adopted it. There was a brief hearing. An IQ test was administered to Carrie. The IQ test was in its earliest form, and someone testified that Carrie had a low IQ. Many years later, then Harvard professor Stephen Jay Gould located Carrie Buck, administered a modern IQ test, and Carrie had an IQ in the normal range. A social worker testified at the hearing and said she had looked at Carrie's baby, who was then 6 months old, and there was, quote, something just not right about her. It was ordered that a tubal ligation be performed on Carrie. The case went to the Supreme Court. This should have been an easy case. The Constitution prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. Carrie had never done anything wrong. Also, the Supreme Court long has said that the word liberty in the Due Process Clause protects fundamental rights. The right to procreate is surely a fundamental right. But the Supreme Court, 8-1, ruled against Carrie Buck. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote the opinion for the court. In some of the most insensitive language found in the United States reports, he uttered that three generations of imbeciles are enough. And as I mentioned, as a result of this decision and the eugenics laws that it upheld, 60,000 people in the United States were involuntarily surgically sterilized.
What if Professor Franklin Roosevelt's effort to expand the number of justices had been successful during the New Deal era?
Well, the Supreme Court in the early 1930s was comprised of elderly justices who had been appointed to the court at a time when there's really a belief in an unregulated economy and social Darwinism. If ever there was a basis or merits for those beliefs, it wasn't by the time the Depression hit in the 1930s. And in so many cases, the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional key pieces of Roosevelt New Deal legislation. Frustrated with this, in 1937, after winning a landslide re-election, Roosevelt proposed court packing. He said, the justices are all old. Let the president have one additional appointment to the Supreme Court for every justice over 70. That would have given Roosevelt six immediate picks to the Supreme Court, a solid majority to approve his New Deal legislation. But one of the justices then on the court, Justice Owen Roberts changed his mind in 1937, began voting to uphold the New Deal legislation, so the need for court packing passed, and 9 has ever since been the number on the Supreme Court.
Interesting. We've talked about some of the worst decisions they've made. What about the best?
Well, I'll start with Marbury versus Madison, which said that courts have the power to enforce the Constitution. I think that there has to be a way of enforcing the limits of the Constitution. If Congress adopts an unconstitutional law, if the president issues an unconstitutional executive order, there has to be someone to stop him. More towards our lifetime, certainly in mine, I'd point to Brown versus Board of Education from May 17, 1954, where the Supreme Court held that separate can never be equal in the realm of public education. Brown ushered in the end of the Jim Crow laws that had segregated the South. How long would it have been if we had to wait for Southern state legislatures to repeal the laws requiring segregation? How long would it have been if we had to wait for Congress to adopt such a statute? We needed the courts here.
We're speaking with renowned constitutional lawyer and author Professor Erwin Chemerinsky. We're going to take a short break on topical currents, but we'll be right back.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Professor Erwin Chemerinsky. He's preeminent constitutional law scholar and the founding dean of University of California Irvine School of Law and a distinguished professor of First Amendment law. He's written The Case Against the Supreme Court. If you'd like to join in the conversation, how do you see the role of the Supreme Court? Do you think they fulfill their role? Do you think they're objective in their decisions? Have you been affected by a particular Supreme Court decision? Call us, 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-9576. Or you can email radio at WLRN.org.
Professor, there's a lot of effort and talk about, particularly from conservatives, to have constitutional amendments to prohibit same-sex marriage, abortion options, and such. But except for two amendments, that would be the 18th and the 22nd, one being prohibition and one being the presidential term limit, amendments have added rights rather than restricting them. What is your view of that?
The Constitution is intentionally very difficult to amend. In fact, I always begin a constitutional law class for law students or for undergraduates by asking them, why have a Constitution? Of course, that requires them to think about how is the Constitution different from all other laws, and the answer is the Constitution is so much more difficult to change. It takes 2/3 of both houses of Congress and 3/4 of the states. There have only been 17 amendments since 1791. You're right, though. In fact, I think prohibition is the only amendment that restricts rights, and it's also the only constitutional amendment that was then overruled and repealed by another amendment. I think that there will continue to be efforts to amend the Constitution, to ban abortion, or to allow school prayer, or to overturn Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission. But it's unlikely that these amendment efforts will get very far.
I'd like to move to the Roberts Court. How do you rate them?
I think this is the most pro-business Supreme Court that we've had since the mid-1930s. In fact, here I can invoke a study that was done by Richard Posner, a federal court of appeals judge, William Landis, a professor at the University of Chicago, and Lee Epstein, a professor at Washington University in St. Louis. And they did a ranking of Supreme Court and Supreme Court justices since the mid-1930s and found that this is the most pro-business court that we've had. The result is it's a court that consistently rules against employees and consumers. It's also a court that consistently rules in favor of government power and against individual rights.
So you're speaking, this could harm Americans on the left and right, both conservative and progressive. Is that right?
Of course. Let me give an example of something that really affects all of us. In a couple of decisions over the last few years, one in 2013 and one in 2011, the Supreme Court has held that makers of generic drugs cannot be sued. They cannot be sued based on a design defect in the drug. They can't be sued for failing to adequately warn consumers about side effects. That means they can't be sued in federal court, and they can't be sued in state court. The most recent case from 2013 involved a woman in New Hampshire who was given a prescription for the pain reliever Sildenafil. Her prescription was filled with the generic form of the drug. She suffered a horrific, rare, though known side effect. Two-thirds of the skin on her body burned, blistered, and decayed. She spent months in a medically induced coma. She's permanently blind and disfigured. But the Supreme Court 5-4 ruled that she couldn't sue the company that made the generic drug. I mention this because I think it so responds to your question. 80% of all prescriptions in the United States are filled with generic drugs. If there's a generic equivalent to the brand name, over 90% of the time, the generic is used to fill that prescription. All who are injured by generic drugs, which could be any of us or our loved ones, can't recover for those injuries.
Why is that? Why did they make that decision?
The Supreme Court, 5-4, interpreted a statute that was adopted to protect consumers to have exactly the opposite effect. The Hatch-Waxman amendments to the Food and Drug Act say that a generic drug can be sold if it's chemically the same as the brand name drug and if it has the warning label that's approved by the brand name drug. This was a law that was meant to make it easier to sell generics to help consumers. But the Supreme Court says, well, it has to have the same warning label as the brand name drug, so it can't be sued for not doing better in warming consumers. And it has to have the same chemical composition as the brand name drug, so it can't be sued for a design defect. So if somebody took the brand name version of Sildenafil and suffered the injury, they could sue the company that made it. But if they took the generic form of the drug, they're just out of luck, no matter how horrific the injuries.
Professor, touch on abuses by the Supreme Court, maybe that's not the correct term, but during times of war, including the Civil War and World Wars I and II.
I think one of the most important functions of the Constitution is to limit what the government can do in times of crisis. The framers knew from history that so often in a crisis, like a war, there's a temptation to centralize power and take away freedom. It's especially then we need the court to stand up to make sure that our short-term passions don't cause us to lose sight of our long-term values. And yet here is a place where the court has especially failed. I'll just give a couple of examples. During World War I, the court allowed individuals to be convicted and imprisoned for speech criticizing the war. One man just circulated a leaflet in which he said that the draft was involuntary servitude in violation of the Constitution. For that, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison. Eugene Debs, the socialist leader, gave a speech to an audience saying, "You are good for more than cannon fodder. There's more I'd like to say, but I can't." For that, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison. And the Supreme Court upheld the convictions and sentences. Or another example I already mentioned, Korematsu versus the United States, where the court upheld the constitutionality of the evacuation of 110,000 Japanese Americans from their West Coast homes and their placement, President Franklin Roosevelt called concentration camps.
Why do you think the Supreme Court has failed on so many levels throughout history?
There's no single answer to that. In part, I think it's because we as a society, including the court, have not clearly enough defined the role we want the court to perform. I think some of it at times is that Supreme Court justices are there for life, and that becomes too long. So in the 1930s, I think the court striking down the crucial New Deal legislation was just justices who had been there too long. I think sometimes through history, it's because presidents have not picked the best and the brightest for their generation to the court. Too often, individuals have been picked because they're friends or political cronies of a president. Sometimes I think it's that the court just falls prey to the same pressures of the rest of society rather than standing up to those pressures.
Had the intense battles for nomination that we've experienced over the past 20 or 30 years, have those always been the case?
Yes, but they occur when the president is of a different political party than the Senate. Over the course of the 19th century, 20% of all presidential picks for the Supreme Court were blocked by the Senate. So those who say that fights over confirmation began with Robert Bork are just wrong in terms of history. But, as I said, if the president is the same political party as the Senate, you almost never see confirmation fights. The president can get who the president wants. Let me contrast. When Ronald Reagan appointed Robert Bork to the Supreme Court, there was a Democratic majority in the Senate, and they blocked Bork. But when President George H.W. Bush appointed Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court, there was a Republican majority in the Senate, and then he was able to have who he wants. When President George W. Bush appointed John Roberts and Samuel Alito, there was a Republican majority. He could have who he wants. When Bill Clinton appointed Ruth Bader Ginsburg, there was a Democratic majority. He could have who he wants. What's interesting is, as of yesterday, I guess when they're sworn in January, we'll have a Democratic president, Republican Senate. That's why I said at the beginning of our conversation, if President Obama has another Supreme Court vacancy to fill in the next 2 years, expect a confirmation fight.
Again, our number, if you have an opinion on the Supreme Court, the Roberts Court, or if you have an opinion generally, if you think the role of this, if the you think the Supreme Court is objective, you can call us 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, or email radio@WLRN.org. We have an emailer, Jim, would like to ask you, Professor, about your opinion on Citizens United and the granting of personhood to corporations. I think it's outrageously corrosive to democracy and justice.
I agree with the person who sent in the email. And in the book, I do discuss this in terms of the Roberts Court and the political process. I think Citizens United is wrong on so many levels. I'm not an originalist. I don't believe that the meaning of the Constitution is limited to what the framers intended. But the conservative justices on the court, like Scalia and Thomas, are self-described originalists. I challenge them or anyone to show that the framers of the First Amendment meant to protect the right of corporations to spend unlimited amounts of money in election campaigns. It's nonsense from that perspective, and it is corrosive and destructive. I worry about how many people will choose never to run for office because they're concerned about the tremendous corporate wealth arrayed against them. I worry about the elections that are going to be decided by corporations being able to simply outspend all others. I worry in judicial elections of judges being elected by the very interests they're going to have cases before them.
Talk about the recent decisions regarding the Voting Rights Act, and do you think yesterday's elections were affected by them?
The key case here was on June 25th, 2013, Shelby County, Alabama versus Holder. It declared unconstitutional key provisions of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. We've got to remember that as recently as 2006, the Senate voted 98-0 to extend these provisions for another 25 years. There were only 33 no votes in the House. President George W. Bush signed it into law. And the effect of the Supreme Court's decision is that no longer do states, local governments, with a history of race discrimination in voting, have to get pre-approval from the Attorney General before they change their election systems. Did it have an effect yesterday? Well, let me give an example. In 2011, Texas adopted the most restrictive voting rights law in the country with regard to photo identification. Unlike other states, Texas won't even accept a photo ID from a four-year Texas university. Texas won't accept photo IDs issued by Native American tribes. A three-judge federal court panel blocked this from going into effect in 2011 under the Voting Rights Act. The Supreme Court declared those provisions of the Voting Rights Act unconstitutional. Texas then immediately put the provisions back into effect. A few weeks ago, a federal district court judge in Texas held a 9-day trial. She wrote a 143-page opinion saying the effect of the Texas law would keep 600,000 people in Texas from voting, primarily African Americans and Latinos. A week ago this past Saturday, on Saturday, October 18th, at about 5:30 a.m. Eastern Time, the Supreme Court blocked the Texas judge's law action from going into effect, allowed the Texas law to be implemented, and so hundreds of thousands of people in Texas couldn't vote yesterday because of that Supreme Court decision.
We're speaking with Professor Erwin Chemerinsky of the University of California, Irvine. We're talking about his book, The Case Against the Supreme Court. We'll take a short break and return with calls and emails. Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Professor Erwin Chemerinsky. We're talking about the Supreme Court. He's the author of The Case Against the Supreme Court and is the founding dean of the University of California, Irvine's School of Law. We'll also have links to the professor and his book on the Topical Currents Facebook page, as well as the website, WLRN.org. An emailer, this is David. Mr. Cooper, I hope you had the courage to ask your guest what his opinion is of the Roe versus Wade decision and its reliance on 45-year-old medical technology, the viability of the fetus, and a completely arbitrary concept of a trimester. Is Roe versus Wade a good decision? Please try not to bias the answer by skewing its wording. I didn't. Let's see if Topical Currents has the moxie to ask the tough questions. Professor?
I'm glad to answer. I don't address Roe versus Wade in this book, though I do in a prior book that I wrote, and I do defend Roe versus Wade. The Supreme Court long has held that privacy is protected as a fundamental right under the liberty of the Due Process Clause. And so the Supreme Court has protected many rights, even though they're not mentioned in the Constitution, under privacy. The right to marry, the right to procreate, the right to custody of one's children, the right to keep the family together, the right of parents to control the upbringing of children, the right to purchase and use contraceptives, the right to refuse medical care, are all protected by the court as fundamental rights under privacy. Laws that prohibit abortion unquestionably infringe a woman's right to privacy. They force her to choose between an unwanted pregnancy and an unsafe back alley abortion. And I think even the opponents of abortion would admit that there is an intrusion on a woman to require to cure a pregnancy to term. The question is, does the state have a compelling interest in stopping abortions so as to protect fetal life? There's no consensus in our society, nor will there ever be, as to when human personhood begins. Some think it begins at conception. Others believe it begins at the time the embryo implants in the uterine wall. Some believe that it begins at quickening, when the woman can first feel the movements of the fetus. Some religions believe that human life begins at birth. What the Supreme Court said is, we're not going to resolve that issue, and it's not for the government to resolve. It's left to each woman to decide for herself up to the point of viability. Viability is the time at which the fetus can survive outside the womb, because after that, we'd all agree, it's a baby.
We have some callers.
I just want to ask, because you mentioned the right. Do you think the court evaded responsibility in not ruling on same-sex marriage?
I do. I believe the court's preeminent role is to interpret and enforce the Constitution. There is a dispute in our country as to whether or not laws prohibiting same-sex marriage deny equal protection to gays and lesbians and violate the fundamental right to marry. I think the court should have taken it and resolved that. The result of the Supreme Court's denying review is will soon be 35 states with marriage equality. But there are still many states, including Florida and others in that part of the country, where the federal courts of appeals haven't ruled. Mm-hmm. There's just legal chaos when same-sex couples can marry in some states but not in others. I think the Supreme Court should have decided the issue.
And why do you think they didn't? Do you have any ideas?
Well, most immediately, I'd say it's because there wasn't yet a difference of opinion, a split between the federal courts of appeals. The four federal courts of appeals to rule so far, the United States Courts of Appeals for the 4th, 7th, 9th, and 10th circuits, have all said that laws prohibiting same-sex marriage violate the Constitution. Florida is in the 11th circuit, which has not yet ruled. But I don't think the court's preeminent role is to resolve conflicts among the circuits. I think it's to interpret the Constitution. More pragmatically, I think what's going on is the four conservative justices, Scalia, Thomas, Alito, and Chief Justice Roberts, don't think that they have a fifth vote to uphold laws prohibiting same-sex marriage. Mm. They don't think they get Kennedy's vote. And the liberal justices followed Justice Ginsburg's lead here and said, no need for us to decide the issue until there's a difference of opinion among the lower courts. That's something Justice Ginsburg said at the University of Minnesota a few months ago.
Speaking of Justice Ginsburg, we have Jim in Lake Worth. Hi.
Hi. Yes, I was wondering if the professor agrees with the Associate Justice Ginsburg was quoted recently saying that she did not think the American form of a constitutional republic, a form of democracy, would necessarily be the best for a country to another country to adopt, as that maybe they come out of, like in the Mideast, some kind of autocracy or monarchy or whatever. And I was just wondering if the professor agrees with Justice Ginsburg that she didn't think the American form of government was all that great.
I'm not sure that's what Justice Ginsburg was saying, but I'll give you my views. Okay. I think that, well, the part that I was questioning, where she said, I don't think she said that American democracy isn't all that great. I think she believes that American democracy is great. But let me put that aside and address your question. Winston Churchill said that democracy is deeply flawed, but it's better than any other form of governing that's ever been created. And I strongly believe that. I think that democracy is the best form of government. Democracy says that it's the people who hold the power, and it's the people who govern. And we may agree or disagree with how people voted yesterday, but that was democracy at work. Now, I think details of democracy can vary country by country. Should it be a president or a prime minister? Should it be a parliamentary form of government, or should it be direct election? Should there be an electoral college? How should you set up the court system? We can argue about all of those details, but I have no doubt that democracy is the very best form of government that people have ever created.
And we'll move along. We've got Mike in Miami. Hey, Mike.
Hi, I just wanted to comment that it's not just what the Supreme Court decides to judge on, it's also what they decide not to listen to. We were affected by a very long 11-year battle regarding a willful copyright infringement by the largest American publisher with the nice yellow borders. And we won in a trial of jury. And then it was sent up to other courts. And what happened was they ruled against us in a way that was completely surprising to everybody who knew these cases. And then when we appealed it to the Supreme Court, they refused to hear it. So you can also have your rights trampled on by what the Supreme Court does not hear.
What is the usual reasoning behind the decision to not or to hear a case?
The problem, and the reason I very much agree with the caller, is the court doesn't give explanations or reasons when it chooses not to hear a case. Last year, the Supreme Court decided 68 cases after brief oral argument. It had about 8,500 petitions for review. There are constantly instances where injustices were done, and yet the Supreme Court, without explanation, just denies review. I had a couple of death penalty cases where I thought there were very strong constitutional arguments, and the Supreme Court denied review. In the book, I argue that when the court denies review like this, they should give some explanation. For the caller, the court denying review was the end of the ability to recover. For my clients on death row, the court denying review meant that they were going to be executed. The court should give some explanation. Otherwise, it just seems like an arbitrary exercise of power.
Okay, Mike, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Again, our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. How do you see the role of the Supreme Court? Do you think they fulfill it? And have you ever been affected by a particular Supreme Court decision? 1-800-743-9576.
Professor, touch on the frequent criticism of both conservatives and the liberal side. The justices are activists. Are they all activists in some way?
Of course they are. Judicial activism is just the label that we use for the decisions we don't like. Compare two cases, both of which we've alluded to. One was on June 25th, 2013, where the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional key provisions of the Voting Rights Act. The majority opinion was written by Chief Justice Roberts, joined by Justice Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, and Alito, the four liberals, Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan dissent. The next day, the Supreme Court strikes down Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act, federal law that says for purpose of federal benefits, marriage has to be between a man and a woman. That case, majority opinion was written by Justice Kennedy, joined by Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, and the four conservatives dissented. So on the first day, it's the conservatives striking down a law. On the second day, it's the liberals striking down a law. Both were activists. It's just they disagreed as to when. both liberals and conservatives are activist justices. They just disagree as to the circumstances of using the judicial power.
How do you feel about the Hobby Lobby ruling?
I'm very critical of it for many reasons. Hobby Lobby, of course, is the case from June 30th, 2014, where the Supreme Court held that it violates the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act to require that a family-held business provide insurance coverage that includes contraceptives that violates the business owner's beliefs. This was the first time in American history that the Supreme Court ever held that a corporation can have religious beliefs. Mm. A corporation is a fictional entity. People create it so there's a separate entity to protect themselves from liability. A corporation can't have a religious conscience. A corporation can't have religious free access. Second, this was the first time in history that the Supreme Court ever held that it infringes free access religion to facilitate what somebody else is going to do. The owners of Hobby Lobby didn't have to use contraceptives. No one was required, obviously, to use contraceptives or prohibited from using them. What if a business is owned by a Christian Scientist? Can't it now say it doesn't have to provide any health insurance to its employees? Also, third, this is the first time in history that the Supreme Court has ever said that people can inflict an injury on others in the name of their free access religion. Many women will not have access to contraceptives because of this decision. Never before had the court allowed people to inflict an injury on others based on free exercise of religion.
So you're saying actually that the last session was remarkable and in an historical context.
I think Hobby Lobby is remarkable, and I think it is a historic landmark. It is a case that's going to open the door to a tremendous amount of additional litigation.
We're listening to Professor Erwin Chemerinsky. He's a preeminent constitutional law scholar and the founding dean of the University of California, Irvine School of Law. He's written The Case Against the Supreme Court. We need to take a last break, and we'll come back with more.
Forty-seven minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's topical occurrence. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. And we resume our conversation with Professor Erwin Chemerinsky. He's the author of The Case Against the Supreme Court. We're getting short on time. Let's go to more calls. James, Dania Beach. Hi, James.
Hi, Professor. I was wondering, do you have an opinion, do you have a view on Justice Scalia's theory of constitutional interpretation, this idea of originalism? Seems to me that it's widely accepted now as a valid theory of constitutional interpretation, notwithstanding that it's that you interpret the Constitution based on the Founding Fathers saw it so many years ago.
I don't accept the premise that it's widely accepted. There are only two justices on the current court, Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas, who are self-professed originalists. There are very few judges in the lower courts who describe them as originalists. There are a handful of law professors who accept this theory and write about it. I think it's deeply flawed. It's hard for me to see how we can be governed under a constitution written in 1787 if we're bound by the framers' original understanding. The Constitution refers to the president and vice president with the pronoun he. Does that then mean it's unconstitutional to elect a woman as president or vice president? The framers surely thought of them just as being men. With regard to Brown versus Board of Education, the same Congress that ratified the 14th Amendment also voted to segregate the District of Columbia public schools. Brown would be wrongly decided. The world is so vastly different today. Also, originalism assumes that there is an original understanding that's out there to be discovered. This morning in class, I taught an issue of constitutional law where James Madison and Alexander Hamilton vehemently disagreed. There are many like that. How do we figure out what's the original understanding under those circumstances?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Professor, before we go, you suggest a number of reforms for the court that would result in significant changes. So let's consider some of those, beginning with how the justices are selected.
I'd like to see us go to a merit selection system for Supreme Court justices. a president could create a merit selection committee. It could be bipartisan. The president would say that any recommendation requires a two-thirds vote, so it would have to be somebody who would please all on the ideological spectrum. And the president would promise to either pick from among the names sent or ask for additional names. There are states that have this system, and it's worked remarkably well. Jimmy Carter created it for his federal district court and federal court of appeals picks, and he picked great judges by all accounts, but he never got a Supreme Court vacancy to fill.
And more calls. This is Mike in Coral Springs. Hi, Mike.
Hi there, Joseph. Thank you so much for taking my call. Thank you so much, Bonnie, and my compliments to Richard Eisen as well. And Professor Chermolinsky, forgive me if I mispronounced your name, I just wanted to mention that I do feel as though I have been affected by the Supreme Court's decision, most certainly, and I feel everyone in our country has, whether it be abortion, whether it be the previous topic of generic drugs, and there are so many other ways that I'm not even aware that I'm affected, but yet I am. Secondly, I just wanted to mention I'm a very patriotic person. My birthday would prove it. I won't say what it is, but it would prove it. But I have to say, in the last few years, it's the first time I've ever really questioned the ability of the average man, the average Abraham Lincoln, so to speak, to make it to the White House, because everything seems to be favoring the rich, and it seems to be blatant. And lastly, there seems to be an agenda when it comes to choosing all of our Supreme Court judges. And what are your thoughts on that?
Let me just stress the last point. Every president through history has had an agenda in picking Supreme Court justices. Every president has wanted to pick justices who have his political philosophy. And that's completely appropriate. That's the democratic check on the court. On the other hand, I also believe it's completely appropriate for the Senate to look at the ideology of the nominees and reject those when they disagree with the person's views. It was completely appropriate for Ronald Reagan to pick Robert Bork because Bork is so conservative. But it's also okay for the Senate to say he's too conservative and then to reject him.
How about justices who've changed their colors greatly after being placed on the court?
It happens remarkably infrequently. Harry Blackmun did.
Souter?
Harry Blackmun came onto the court quite conservative, and by the time he left, he was the most liberal justice. Felix Frankfurter went on the court, and everyone thought he was going to be very liberal and turned very conservative. For David Souter, though, I don't think anyone knew what his ideology was when he went onto the Supreme Court. I remember going and reading all of his decisions when he was a member of the New Hampshire Supreme Court. And I think New York University law professor Bert Newborn put it best when he said, the only thing you can conclude from reading all of Souter's opinions from the New Hampshire Supreme Court is that the New Hampshire Supreme Court has a really boring docket. No one knew what Souter was going to be. And it turned out that Souter was much more liberal than President George H.W. Bush or those who were responsible for his appointment ever could have imagined.
I want to get back to some more of your reforms before we go. You suggest term limits for court justices. And I think it's interesting that you agree with Governor Rick Perry. How would term limits improve the court?
I think this is the one proposal that I make that would require a constitutional amendment. Like Governor Perry, I argue for 18-year non-renewable terms. Life expectancies today, thankfully, are much longer than they were in 1787. Clarence Thomas was confirmed for the Supreme Court in 1991 when he was 43 years old. If he remains on the court until he's 90, the age at which Justice Stevens retired, Clarence Thomas will be on the Supreme Court for 47 years. Elena Kagan and John Roberts reached 50 when they were confirmed at the court. If they remain till they're 90, they'll be 40 years. That's too much power exercised by a single person for too long a period of time. Also, too much now depends on the accident when vacancies occur. Richard Nixon had 4 vacancies to fill in his first 2 years as president. Jimmy Carter had no vacancies to fill in his 4 years as president. 18-year non-renewable terms would mean that every 2 years there'd be a vacancy to fill. Every president would get about equal influence over the future of the Supreme Court.
So if it would require a constitutional amendment, how realistic is it that it could ever happen?
As I already said, the Constitution's only been amended 17 times since 1791, so that makes one think it's unlikely.
Right.
On the other hand, I speak to a lot of audiences, and it's interesting how widespread the support is for term limits. I gave a talk a week ago Monday night at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and there were about 600 people in the audience. The place where I got interrupted for spontaneous applause is when I said there should be term limits on Supreme Court justices. If a liberal like me and a conservative like Rick Perry can agree on something, maybe it really is possible.
And we have one last email, and we just have about a couple of minutes left. Could you ask the professor to comment on the International Dairy Foods Association versus the AG of Vermont about not having to label genetically modified foods? I think it's one of the worst disasters in the court's history.
This is not a constitutional question. This is a question of interpreting a federal statute. And of course, whenever the court's interpreting a statute, if Congress doesn't like it, Congress can change that law.
And I guess so they did. Why did you write this book now, Professor?
As I was saying earlier in our conversation, as I was thinking about it and how I was talking about the court in teaching constitutional law, I realized that I was too often making excuses for the court, and that I believe if the court's going to get better, it has to be if we recognize its failings. And so I decided I wanted to write a book titled The Case Against the Supreme Court to force people, liberal and conservative, Democrat and Republican, to think more critically about the court and to think about how we can make it better.
Well, it's been a pleasure pondering some of your ideas, Professor.
Yes.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Professor Erwin Chemerinsky. He's a preeminent constitutional law scholar and the founding dean of the University of California Irvine School of Law and distinguished professor of First Amendment law. He's written The Case Against the Supreme Court. And as Joe said, we will have links to the professor and his book on our website, WLRN.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we hope you enjoyed the discussion. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. He's responsible for the Topical Currents Facebook page and our section of the WLRN website. Find free audio downloads at WLRN.org and more information, links, photos, and discussion on our Facebook page. Tomorrow's program begins with an examination of one of Bonnie's exceptional skills, wit.
Thanks.
We'll visit with Canadian editor Benjamin Arrett. He's put together the book, The Elements of Wit, Mastering the Art of Being Interesting. And Linda Gassenheimer with writer and critic Jen Koretnik, known among friends as the Mango Mama. She tends to 11 mango trees in her South Florida orchard. Koretnik's new book is, surprise, Mango.
How witty.
If you try and be witty, you never are. That's what the author says.
Mm-hmm.
Also tomorrow, we'll have our favorite wine columnist, Fred Tasker. He's now tasting mango wines. Probably has a little buzz.
As usual.
This is Joseph Cooper, along with longtime colleague Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR News.